Welcome to Between the Vines. My name's Kevin Martin. I'm here with Jennifer Phillips Russo. For the moment, we are the Lake Erie Regional Grape Program team, hopefully a little bit bigger pretty soon. But for now, the two of us are here to update you again on some of the dormant season activities of the Lake Erie Regional Grape Program and what is going on in the region. I know Jen's been cutting buds, but it's still pretty early on. We've had, one or two snowfalls at this point. It's December 2nd, so not a whole lot there. But Jen, is there anything you want to discuss in terms of bud cutting, or do you want to jump into some other things?
No, yeah, we can start with the bud cutting. I just wanted to let everybody know that when we do research at the Lake Erie Regional Grape Program, it is guided by grower and industry input. So it's not like I go out and just say, you know, wouldn't it be really cool if I could study this and pick any topic and go out and study it. We actually take our advisory committee meeting and our field rep meetings and talk to the industry to see what, in fact, they are concerned with and if there's anything that they want us to test. So we are constantly monitoring certain varieties here for cold hardiness, and we do that weekly. The way that happens is we go out and collect wood from our vines once a week. Then we put them in our 10E2 freezer, which has it's basically cells that we cut the buds in. We put them in, and when things die, living material dies, it puts off a spike of heat. And then this machine can record that spike of heat and tell us that when 50% of the buds could die, 100% of the buds could die, at what temperatures. It's a step down process. So this kind of informs you guys if you need to go out and be concerned. Maybe you were thinking of pruning and then you saw that temperatures got too low and you're afraid that there might be 50% damage, so you're going to delay your pruning until springtime. That is something that we do on a weekly basis starting November 1st, and we usually end at March 31st. I can tell you that that information will be posted shortly. We have, I believe, 4 weeks of that, three weeks of that already collected and analyzed. Not analyzed. I should back up and just say collected. We're waiting for code to be written so that we can just plug the data in and it'll be super simple, because it usually takes me about 4 hours going through the data to try to get just a graph for you to understand. So hopefully just a click of a button. I'm just waiting on that, and we'll have that information up on the website for you. That's one of the research projects that we do for cold hardiness in the wintertime. There are two others that we applied for. One was supported by the New York Wine and Grape Foundation. And when I say we, I mean Dr. Jason Londo and myself. He is a Cornell fruit physiologist. And the other one was paid for or awarded money from New York Farm Viability Institute. So two different organizations in New York are finding this research important and funding it so that we can bring you some answers. One of those would be, we call it sort of a spray and pray program. There has been a special combination of chemicals that has worked on other commodities to increase cold hardiness when you spray it on. Well, we sprayed the leaves 3 times after harvest. We are testing a control and 3 other formulations. And now we're going to collect the buds and see if we can see any increase in cold hardiness to maybe help some of those more, you know, frost tender, cold tender varieties to have a couple more degrees of cold hardiness throughout the winter. Because sometimes it is just a couple degrees before we see, you know, 40, 50% damage in our vineyards. So we're going to be monitoring that, but I probably won't present that information until after we have 2 years of study. But we are currently in the throes of it all. Then our last one that I'm doing with Dr. Londo is studying microclimates. Some of you might remember Dr. Terry Bates's 9-site study that he did, where we looked at 3 sites on the lake, 3 sites on the bench, and then 3 sites in the escarpment, and collected lots of data. We are sort of looking at that in terms of cold hardiness. So we have these microsensors that are out there. Kevin, can I share my screen just for those people who absolutely might be watching it? And I just want to show them what they look like, because we did have one grower say, "What is this in my vineyard?" And it was before I had a chance to share the picture with him. So if you see these out in the vineyard, please leave them alone. Can you see the screen, Kevin?
Yes. Yep. So what's that doing for you?
There are each one of those little brackets we have, which is a weather shield over these, is a sensor. And the sensor itself, I'll actually pull the one up because we went out and checked them today, is not only checking temperature at that sensor, every minute it's recording a temperature every minute right at the fruiting level on the top wire cordon for Concords. And that's the only variety that we're studying in the Lake Erie region for this particular grant. And then also at the ground level. So we can see the differences in the temperature on both of those and collecting wood and testing it for cold hardiness. But not only do we look at temperature, we are also looking at relative humidity, the barometric pressure, the dew point, and just lots of data that those tiny little sensors are collecting so that we can then, we always give you, I'll stop my share. We always give you information that we take from Portland, and Portland is the Cornell Agritech station that we are based out of, where our research vineyards are. So all of that information is then given to everyone to kind of look at the critical temperatures at this point. This is what we are, but it's right here at Portland and we happen to be on the bench. So we wanted to see if there's any difference between the lake, the bench, and the escarpment so that we can maybe fine tune those temperatures for people as we go on further into this. And that again is a 2-year study.
Of course there will be, right?
Right, but maybe we can get some information, get closer for people. Right.
Yeah, I mean, I can see this going two ways, right? There could be some modeling things that could be done based on location that improve how the results work for you. Maybe we could link it to NUA. I think, is that part of the plan potentially down the road?
Potentially down the road, that is what we're talking about. Right. And he's definitely a modeling person.
And I believe these sensors are commercially available as well. So if you want to figure out what's going on in your vineyard, there's probably not a ton of excitement in Concord vineyards because they're relatively cold hardy, but sometimes some pretty invasive procedures take place in vinifera or other varieties that might be, somewhat dependent on temperature, late pruning and pruning styles and things like that. So you could just buy one of these too. And the other thing you can do to measure cold hardiness on your own vineyard is to wait. So if you have a good idea of whether or not you think you had a cold spot and you can measure it, you'll know once those buds start to push in the spring. Okay. So, so I think you could use just the temperature data to do some more invasive, more hands-on practices in your vineyard if you're doing something like vinifera. These are not sensors that Jennifer programmed or are not commercially available. If you want temperature data, you can get it. It's fairly affordable. On quarter acre grids for a Concord grower, it would get pretty expensive, but for vinifera, you could just do it.
In all honesty, and don't quote me on this, these are just ballpark figures. I think it was about $130 a sensor for the more evolved one. And these ones we're using are about $100 a sensor. So yeah, it's definitely doable. And they do give you some great information. The thing that I am enjoying is that it's done by Bluetooth.
Right. So, I mean, that's sort of what made me bring it up is we've certainly done this temperature data in the past, but it was very much so geared. I mean, this is geared towards science too, right? But the user friendliness of it really wasn't there. And I wouldn't see any grower using some of those older pieces of technology, but this, where it just sort of goes to your phone, you get the data, you transfer it to your computer to analyze the data. That kind of changes it. You don't bring the sensor in and download the data. You just sort of drive by. Yeah. You may have to pause for a minute, but just the user friendliness of it. I could see it being implemented in actual vineyards as well.
I'm sure when we do the write-up, it would be included. So anybody who is interested, and there are probably other ones out there as well, but so far I'm really, and we've only been doing it for 2 weeks, enjoying these sensors. So
I have some reminders about some of the, I think I would say just educational work we've done in the past. But before we get to that, because if you don't need reminding, you might just tune us out here.
Reminded of the good work that we do? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, I'm not saying it's good work or bad. It's bad work, right? Because I just got some feedback that some of the growers, might not be aware of some of these things. So I just want to make sure growers are aware. And even if you've heard this before, maybe mention it at the coffee pot for somebody at the coffee shop for somebody who doesn't listen, because there are some mistakes being made. And I want to prevent those, but I don't always know how in terms of making sure everybody hears the correct message. So, but before we do get to that, we do have some meetings coming up.
Yes. Do you have those pulled up right in front of you? Because I can talk about the one on December 9th, and it'll take me a minute to pull up the ones that I sent in the crop update, which is not an issue. I can certainly do that.
So we can start with our own personal meetings with, or I guess administered by the Lake Erie Regional Grape Program. And what's coming up for us, as you guys sort of know, even if you haven't heard anything recently, is we're going to have a winter growers conference. So the update there, what you may have heard is, again, like last year, this is going to be a hybrid event, and not in the way that some growers may complain because they're sick of virtual. It's hybrid in the sense that we are going to have an event on December 9th that is virtual, an event on February 9th that is virtual, and an in-person full conference, just like in the past, on March 16th at the SUNY Fredonia Williams Center. So you can go to our website, lergp.cce.cornell.edu, look at our events, and you'll see that. You can register for some of it or all of it. And we understand that, you know, some of the local people are really only going to make space for an in-person conference. And we also have had some interest outside of the region for people who are just realistically can't attend our in-person conference because they might not even be in the United States. Mm-hmm. So there's a couple of different ways you can attend. You can register now for all of those or some of them. You want to talk about December 9th?
I absolutely do.
Okay.
So the Lake Erie Regional Grape Program put together a meeting, and we've done this meeting very similar to two in the past. We call it the spray program meeting, What's Your Plan? So we have Brian Head from I always want to call them the Lake Erie Regional Grape Program, but I don't know the acronym, the Lake Erie Research and Laboratory for PS. And he is going to be talking about basically some research that he's been doing in powdery mildew, testing different chemicals and what he has seen and what he is finding. And there's some very interesting results that are coming out of that. We know that a lot of you are looking to purchase your chemicals soon. So we wanted to We used to have this meeting in April, and then we moved it up to February, and now we're putting it in December from feedback from some of you that you would like to have this meeting before you purchase your chemicals, hence the December 9th. Brian,
and I will just say one thing about that. The name of the meeting is Spray Program, What's Your Plan? I think we can touch on, or we will talk about, Brian will talk about sort of the two different plans that existed in the past. And obviously, there were more than two, like every grower does is it's their own thing. But there are fundamentally two, I would categorize them as two different models, maybe three of controlling powdery mildew in particular. Especially in situations where Brian is studying, which is where pressure for powdery mildew in 2022 was moderate to light, there should be a different plan. And that's all I'm gonna say.
Right.
We can talk about it more if you missed that meeting later on, but I'm going to let Brian tell you sort of what maybe that plan looks like. And again, it's a category of plan, right? Like this is not going to be, you should spray this chemical on this day. It is a strategy, I think, that we have not used in the last 10 or 15 years because we haven't been able to. So I think in certain instances, we can now use this strategy. So he'll talk about what that strategy is and how you execute it with what we've got.
Very well said. Thank you. And I should also mention that this is not geared specifically towards Concord growers. There's also going to be time and talk for other hybrids and vinifera. So please don't feel that if you are not a Concord grower that you can't join us for this program, because there's going to be a lot of great information shared.
Yeah, Doctor, I know.
Go ahead.
Oh.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you, Kevin. Either I froze or you froze for a quick second. So apparently it was I who froze because Kevin just fell out of the meeting for a minute. But I'll go on to just explain to you that our other guest speaker that day is Dr. Katie Gold from Cornell University. She is the grape pathologist there, and she's going to be talking about some research that she's been doing with some biofungicides. So There's some that are promising. She's going to talk about how they work and what they are, what she's tested, and how you might be able to incorporate them into your spray program and then extend the life of some of the chemicals that we need. So I do hope that you join us during that time. Another great thing about this meeting, so it's December 9th. It is a Zoom meeting. You must pre-register. There is a fee for this meeting. It's a $25 fee. However, for that, you are getting 3 New York State pesticide recertification credits. And for Pennsylvania, you are getting 4 private category and 2 core credits awarded for this meeting. So that comes, it is also being recorded. However, you cannot get credits if you are not live. It will be available for you afterwards for you to be able to access, but you cannot get credit for it from either PDA or New York if you are not live. I guess I'll talk about the next ones. This is just turning out to be the Jennifer show. I think Kevin's having connectivity issues. So we have a group. We're calling ourselves the Eastern Viticulture and Enology Forum. And we have viticulture and enologists from Cornell Agritech, Virginia Tech, and Penn State Extension. We have all gotten together and put together a webinar series through the winter months so that you have some more education when we can. Kevin's back. Yay. Kevin, I already talked about all of the credits and everything for the for our meeting. And now I just started talking about the Eastern Viticulture and Enology Forum.
Awesome. Okay.
So
yeah,
yes.
Eastern is, yeah, that's going to be a great setup. A little bit more geared towards wine grapes, just in the experience that those growers have. There's some researchers that just don't have access to Concord, but I would encourage growers who are interested in those topics in general to just attend. And if there needs to be a translation through this podcast about how that applies to Concords, we'll do it. And in a lot of instances, I don't think there will be. It's just grapes are grapes. So that's sort of what I would encourage. I don't know if maybe you already said that, but
I didn't, but I would like to touch base on, we have a December meeting, a January, February, and March meeting. Mm-hmm. Again, they're all virtual and they are set in the afternoon for those. I believe all of them, I could be wrong, but I believe all of them are set in the afternoon, like 3:30-ish. All this information will be on our website and you should also get it. For those of you who are not members of our program, our website can be found at lergp.cce.cornell.edu, where we will have an events page and these will be listed there. So the one in December it's on December 13th, if you want to mark your calendars, if you're interested in H2A labor program fundamentals from perspectives of the vineyard owners and Cornell Agricultural Workforce Development. So we're going to have Richard Stupp. If you've been to our grower meetings in the past, he has presented on labor issues. He's a dynamic speaker. And then we have 3 growers on a panel where they're going to talk about their struggles, trials, tribulations, and maybe help you get through that process as well.
And I would say, yeah, we've got wine grape growers, Concord growers. This is kind of what I tried to plan this summer. That was in person, but it could have been better, because with more planning comes better programming, right? And we just wanted to make sure we could do something this summer to prepare growers to get H2A workers this winter. At this point, it's not super timely. So we'll just try to get, I think, you know, Kane and everyone involved is trying to just get the best H2A information we can get out to growers, because it's not going to happen for 2023 or 2022, 2023 dormant season. But, you know, I think everybody knows that it's possible that whatever they have for labor this year doesn't exist next year. And everybody's been thinking that for the last decade. So, you know, at the very least, it's time to learn about how to machine prune. It's time to learn about H2A workers and learn about solutions, even if you don't implement any of them immediately.
Right. And our January, we're going to be on January 10th. And that is going to be Fritz Westover. So he is the viticulturalist and founder of Westover Vineyard Advising. He's going to talk about corrective measures to the top 10 dormant pruning mistakes in commercial vineyards. So if you had issues or wondered why, it's going to be a great program for him to talk about what he has seen out there in the many vineyards that he advises. And he advises all over, not just where he is located, and how to mitigate those and be more efficient with your pruning practices. In February, we have our Dr. Katie Gold, who is going to be in our December 9th, and she's going to be talking about the same thing, academic and industry perspectives on biofungicide use in vineyards. So that's another one for those of you, if you missed it in the first one that we have on December 9th, you can catch her on that one. And on March 7th, we have Greg Jones, who is the CEO of, oh my gosh, I'm going to murder it. I don't even know if I want to murder it. Abicella? Might be Abicello Winery. So I have to say that I caught a segment on 60 Minutes of Greg Jones' interview about climate change implications for grapevine production in wine regions of the United States. And thought that it might be, I'm not sure if everybody saw that segment, but I found it very useful and interesting. So we have invited him to come talk about that talk that he gave and his research and what he finds out. And that's going to be in March.
Awesome. Okay. So some of what I have just relates very slightly to that first H2A talk, but I'm not really going to talk about H2A. I just wanted to make sure, and you can see this in our crop update this week if you want to reference some of the details, if I gloss over anything or if you miss something and want it in writing. But in New York State, ag workers are now required to be paid overtime. That's been the case, I think, since 2019. There has been a fundamental change in how that works. And the fundamental change is they're planning on changing it. So this is very important to articulate depending on which newspaper you read or which headline you read, because you really need to read the article. So New York State is moving to a 40-hour work week for agriculture, which means at some point, if a worker works 41 hours in a week, they will have to be paid 1 hour of overtime, time and a half. That is in 10 years. That is not today. You do not have to pay time and a half on 40 hours right now. Right now, it is still at the 60-hour threshold, with the exception of the required day of rest. And if the employee agrees to work on his or her day of rest, then he or she needs to be paid time and a half. That holds true whether or not they worked 60 hours or 7 hours. That day of rest is just based on how many days they worked, not the threshold of hours.
Oh, so I always thought that they were mandatory days of rest. So they have the option to do it.
It is mandatory, but theoretically or technically, there needs to be consent by both parties to work on that seventh day.
And so the person working says, yes, I'll work on my day off. But the person who is employing says, but I have to pay you time and a half.
Got it. And there, I mean, one important caveat to that, we've been over this, but maybe it's good to have a reminder. You can change that day of rest based on weather-related events. You cannot change that day of rest based on whatever day they were busier. So if you have a harvest season where they work 30 days in a row, you can't just go through those weeks and pick the hours where they work the least amount. I don't exactly know how that's enforced practically speaking, but certainly if on Wednesday it rained and Sunday's their day of rest, Wednesday can become their day of rest. So the way I've always thought that growers are probably in compliance is if there's a day that they work 0 hours, that can be a day of rest, especially during harvest. They don't want you switching it around just for the fun of it to try to torture your workers. But I think during harvest, you probably get an understanding of that. Same thing, even during pruning, you'll probably get some understanding there if they're taking the days off because of weather-related events like a blizzard. But if they're just taking that day off and it's not their day of rest, I'm not sure if there's no weather-related event. And certainly if they're working a partial day just because, you know, there's less load scheduled for harvest that day, that definitely doesn't work. So you want to keep it to a day of rest. And it does not have to be a Saturday or Sunday. It is preferred that if they are religious, it's on their religious day of rest, but it does not have to be. So you could sort of try to plan for when you knew days were going to be slow. Like if a facility always has no formal scheduling during harvest on a Sunday, or they do cleanups every other Monday, you can sort of predict that you might lower your burden if that's what you assign as the day of rest, knowing that they've agreed to work Mondays, they might get two of those Mondays off and you'd avoid overtime. Now, so for what the change is going to be, we know it's going to go from 60 hours to 40 hours. It's changing so much and so often. It's kind of like minimum wage has changed in New York, only worse. So you're probably not going to remember all these dates. But on January 1st, 2024, it will change to 56 hours. And then every other year, so every even year on January 1st, so 2024, 2026, 2028, 2030, 2032, it's going to be reduced by 4 hours. So it'll go from 56 hours to 52 to 48 to 44 to 40.
Got it. So you have time to adjust, and you have 2 years to adjust to the new.
Right. Now, the important thing here, the thing that a grower could be excited about, but probably shouldn't be, because I wouldn't count on it. I don't know. But anyway.
Pull it back.
Yeah. I'm not sure if you should be excited or not. But for any overtime costs above and beyond the current standard, so for any overtime paid for these lower thresholds, if somebody works, say, 57 hours, they get 1 hour of overtime in 2024. That 1 hour of overtime is subject to overtime pay because of these lower thresholds, not the standard 60 hour. In those situations, right now in the budget, there is funding to provide a refundable tax credit of 118% of the cost of the overtime. So for every dollar of overtime you pay, you'll get $1.18, except for the fact you won't get anything for paying on the day of rest. You won't get anything for paying overtime over 60 hours. But for these new thresholds, there is a refundable tax credit. Obviously, I believe that was passed in the budget. So as long as it's in the budget, it will exist. And if it's ever taken out of the budget, it won't exist. And right now, the budget cost of that program is $0 because there is no required overtime. So this is only, it only provides funding if the overtime is actually required. So you could pay overtime for 40 hours, but until it's legally required, that credit also doesn't exist. Huh. So, Cornell has done and has updated a study and a survey on how farmers adapted to the New York State overtime requirements. These overtime requirements are, of course, limited to the current overtime requirements because the new ones do not exist yet. Essentially, growers and specialty crop growers and dairy really haven't done anything to adjust for overtime. They just pay overtime. There have been a few things that were identified by a minority of growers. So 38% of specialty crop growers are starting to buy machinery and equipment to improve labor productivity. That's probably the biggest thing that people are doing. They're hiring other employees, but with little success. So most growers have not said that they're actually hiring additional employees, but a few have. It's under 30% have done that. But those are pretty much the two most popular things that people have done. Another thing that growers are doing is implementing a hard stop. So,
hard stop.
You hit your 60 hours, your work's done. Whether that, strawberries are in the field, pruning has yet to be done, it doesn't matter. Like, you're just done at 60 hours. If that means that fruit rots or vines don't get pruned, that's fine. We're just not going to pay overtime. And that's been a fairly somewhat popular practice, and popular enough to be worth mentioning. But really, the majority of growers have two things in common, that they are implementing tighter controls to try to make sure that growers aren't working 7 hours a week and getting paid overtime by working on their day of rest. And they are just continuing as usual and paying some overtime. Those are pretty much the most popular things growers are doing. So, you know, there are a lot of things you could theoretically do to reduce overtime costs, and growers are not doing them. I think growers are not doing them because the labor market is tight. So you could try to do these things, but I don't have a lot of hope that they're realistic. You could, you know, reduce the base cost of employee pay to offset the cost of overtime. You could reduce benefits. You could outsource existing tasks to reduce labor needs. Growers are doing that, all of those things, as in like one grower here, two growers there, four growers across the state. Most of those things are single digit, and it's because, you know, you can certainly try to do that, but it isn't working right now.
Yeah, the whole reducing so you can pay the overtime, I think that would have to be somebody who has dedicated people that are constantly working overtime.
And they just won't agree to it right now. Because why would you?
Right.
You know, why would I take $17 an hour instead of $18 just so you can pay me overtime? That does exist. That those things happen when the unemployment rate is 10%. They don't happen in situations like this. They usually happen with newer employees. So when you have turnover, you might have a shot. Again, when business owners are in the driver's seat, not when the labor force is in the driver's seat. But, you know, I don't know when that's going to be. I would venture to say on this side of never until we see substantial policy changes, because right now we're seeing a tight labor market overall and then in agriculture, but there's no indication that we'll ever see anything but a tight labor market in agriculture. I'm not saying it couldn't change, but there needs to be policy change for that to change. So, I mean, the market itself is going to continue to be tight.
Certainly is tight. That's one of our number one things that we hear about when we're talking with growers.
Yeah, the only other update I have is we've talked a lot about fertilizer prices because, you know, in 2021 they went crazy. So everybody wanted to talk about fertilizer prices because, you know, when they go up 15% a week, it's very interesting. They're pretty boring right now in the sense that since April, they are, and there's exceptions if you look at individual fertilizers, but overall, everything is very, very slowly declining since April. It's all much, much, much more expensive than it was in 2020. It's all much, much more expensive than it was at the beginning of 2021. But it is now getting close to the point where it is backing off the highest of the highs in 2021. In the beginning part of 2022, prices did go up during the planting season. For field crops. So we're still, you know, have a long way to go to with these very slight, small declines to get anywhere back to what somebody sitting around in 2020 thought was a reasonable price for fertilizer. How much of this is a reality of the market and how much of it is temporary based on either temporary commodity prices or permanent commodity prices, that's a lot of speculation. A lot of people have been saying since August that, you know, prices of fertilizer are going to go up or are not going to fall. You know, I'm not saying that the price of potassium is in August. You know, it was around 880, 890 is what it peaked at in July. So it's steadily declined to 848. That's not a real substantial change. You know, we were seeing price increases of $50 a ton in a week in 2021. But I don't know which direction it's going to go. The volatility does seem to have pretty much disappeared in the last 6 months. So until something changes, like the war in Ukraine gets substantially worse or substantially better, or whatever factor that triggered a major event happens again, the volatility is probably gone until something big happens. But inevitably something big will happen, whether it's commodity prices or a war or shipping issues. I don't know which direction it will happen in.
Well, that makes me a little bit nervous, because when it first started and things started skyrocketing, we were like, okay, if there is something that you need to dial back on, then you can dial back on your fertilizer inputs a little bit, as long as you have such and such organic matter, usually between 3 and 5%. We were talking about that because people were really nervous about what they were going to put out in costs. It is definitely evident in some of our vineyards in the belt that I've gone around that not caring for or putting inputs in has been a little bit detrimental to some of our vineyards, as well as the extremely large crop that we had and then the weather issues that we had. So there's compounding factors, but I think that everyone does need to do some sort of maintenance on your inputs this year for fertilizer. And I know that the prices are high, but I don't think that we can keep going and taking nutrients out of the vineyard and not putting them back. We've seen, you know.
I mean, so efficient application of nitrogen through urea, if it's done efficiently, is fairly affordable. If it's not done efficiently, it's very expensive. So if you need to put on 150 pounds of nitrogen and your organic matter is 2%, if the reason you need to do that is because the uptake is so inefficient because of the way you're putting it on, yes, urea can be expensive. If you follow the recommended practices of how to use urea and when to put it on, and you also start to consider a split application earlier than you would have normally because you're trying to increase efficiency because of the uptake because the price is higher, so you start to think dynamically about your behavior based on price, it's not that expensive. You know, a 50 pound rate of urea is $40 an acre.
That sounds doable. I mean,
right. So above $40 an acre is when you maybe want to start thinking about split applications. Below 50 pounds per acre, you certainly don't need to think about split applications, and you're in the area of what a maintenance application is. 50 to 75 is probably a pretty high maintenance application of urea. That's not to say that growers with very low organic matter don't need more. And it's not to say that growers who have really low pH, even on heavy soils, don't need some more as well. But certainly if you have sort of a CEC that's very difficult to change, like if you're farming on sand, you're going to benefit from split applications even more. So
just the mechanics of it, you know.
One application of urea should never cost more than $50 an acre plus the cost of putting it down. If it costs more than that, you should split it. That's not to say that it's not expensive. It's just that's going to increase your efficiency enough so that you shouldn't realize a substantial cost increase in urea. You're just use it more efficiently so that the price doesn't impact you. Potash is another story. I mean,
there's a lot of black leaf out there though this year. So
yeah, I mean, there's some of that's lack of rain, right? I hope. Yeah.
Yes. But then that was lack of rain in, you know, June and July. We had some in August and definitely some in September.
And I would say there was definitely substantial differences in black leaf in that there's vineyards right next to each other where there's some and then, or a lot. So obviously we were on the edge of being able to manage through that drought with adequate applications of potash, and some growers looked at $887 a ton and decided not to make robust applications of potash. So now at $800 a ton, it'll be time to place a little bit of catch up.
Thank you. Supporting exactly where I was going for.
So, yeah, like you said, it is still expensive, and putting it off didn't do anything positive yet.
Right.
Because we're, you know, if it ever got to 500, it's like, okay, then you missed the bubble, but it's not going to get to 500 fast enough. Somebody's going to have to buy 200 to 300 pounds of expensive potash per acre over the course of a few years, not necessarily all at once, in that $800 range.
And you know your fields, you know where you saw it, you know where if you need to ration it, where to start and where not to apply. So I would consider doing a maintenance application on all of your acreage this year if you have been neglecting it.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for supporting that.
Phosphorus has been some of the most expensive stuff. Those prices have backed off. So if you need a little phosphorus, you can back off the recommended rates if you see deficiency and try to be very efficient about your phosphorus application. Use cover crops and things like that because most phosphorus is typically wasted. So, I've seen results in petiole samples at 20 pounds per acre where you can see the phosphorus move. Most of our recommends are more than that because the recommends are based on historical information where phosphorus uptake efficiency was just lower. So, try to increase the efficiency of the uptake and, send in your soil samples, get those recommends from Jennifer, and when she tells you how to put it on, just put it on that way.
There's if and then statements, so you know your vineyard. If this, then do this.
Right, but so we go by the book, right, with those phosphorus recommendations. And the book is about to be updated in the next 3 years, but it's going to take research to update it. So in the meantime, if you don't like paying $1,000 a ton for 50 pounds of phosphorus, come up with ways to put it on more efficiently and put down 30 or 20 and then do it again the next year. Because if you put down 50 a year in grapes, you're going to get to a point where if that is being taken up by the soil and becoming available, you're not going to need any for years and years. And that's what we've seen is people used to put down a lot of phosphorus through alternative fertilizer methods, and they didn't need any for 20 years, and now all of a sudden they need some. So what's the most efficient way to put it on?
You're clicking your pen. It sounds like you're nervous.
But oh, sorry, it's actually a pair of pruning shears. But that's about all I have. I mean, fertilizer right now is pretty boring. It is declining slowly. I don't really have any advice about where it's going to go. It typically will continue to slowly decline until planting season, and then sort of all bets are off. It'll be driven based on what's going on in field crops and what we actually see USDA data come in through with acres of field crops planted and what mix of plantings are happening, beans versus wheat versus corn. And so once that happens, that will move the price some, but it's really impossible to try to predict that direction. It will move it up some if commodity prices stay where they are, but that's a really big if.
Well, we've talked a lot more than we thought we were going to talk about today.
Whoops.
No, that's great. I just want to kind of circle back to remind you that on December 9th, we have a really great program to help you think about what your chemical needs are going to be for your spray program this coming year. So we have Brian Head from PSU and Dr. Katie Gold from Cornell University. Lots of credits available for this particular meeting, 3 for New York State and 6 for Pennsylvania, including 2 core credits. I know that's a hot commodity for Pennsylvania growers. So register. You can find the link on our webpage given earlier, lergp.cce.cornell.edu. And hopefully we'll see you next Friday.
All right, thanks a lot. We will see you next week. If there's anything we didn't touch on that you want to hear about, just feel free to contact us and we'd be happy to do that. We love doing that.
Have a great week, everyone.